do the talking. You don't need to fervently communicate your goals. People can just extrapolate from the momentum of the flywheel for themselves. Hey, if we just keep doing this, look where we can go. As people decide among themselves to turn the fact of potential into the fact of results, the goal almost sets itself. Stop and think for a minute. What do the right people want more than anything else? They want to be part of a winning team. They want to contribute to producing visible, tangible results. They want to feel the excitement of being involved in something that is just flat out outstanding, that flat out works. When the right people see a simple plan, hedgehog, born of confronting the brutal facts, a plan developed from understanding, not bravado, they are likely to say, that'll work, count me in. When they see the monolithic unity of the executive team behind the simple plan and the selfless, dedicated qualities of level 5 leadership, they'll drop their cynicism. When people begin to feel the magic of momentum, when they begin to see tangible results, when they can feel that flywheel beginning to build speed, it's almost physical. That's when the bulk of people line up, throw their shoulders against the wheel, and push. The doom loop. We found a very different pattern at the comparison companies. Instead of that quiet, deliberate process of figuring out what needed to be done, and then simply doing it, the comparison companies frequently launched new programs, often with great fanfare and hoopla aimed at motivating the troops, only to see the programs fail to produce sustained results. They sought that single defining action, the grand program, the one killer innovation, the miracle moment that would allow them to skip the arduous build-up stage and jump right to breakthrough. They would push the flywheel in one direction, then stop, change course, throw it in a new direction. And then they would stop, change course, and throw it into yet another direction. After years of lurching back and forth, the comparison companies failed to build sustained momentum and fell instead into what we came to call the doom loop. Consider the case of Warner Lambert, the direct comparison company to Gillette. In 1979, Warner Lambert told Business Week that it aimed to be a leading consumer products company. 1 year later, in 1980, it did an abrupt about-face and turned its sights on healthcare, saying, "Our flat-out aim is to go after Merck, Lilly, SmithKline, everyone and his brother." In 1981, the company reversed course yet again and returned to diversification in consumer goods. 6 years after that, in 1987, Warner Lambert did another U-turn away from consumer goods to try once again to be like Merck. At the same time, the company spent three times as much on consumer goods advertising as on R&D, a somewhat puzzling strategy for a company trying to beat Merck. In the early 1990s, reacting to Clinton-era healthcare reform, the company threw itself into reverse yet again and re-embraced diversification and consumer brands. Each new CEO brought his own new program and halted the momentum of his predecessor. Ward Hagen tried to create a breakthrough with an expensive acquisition in the hospital supply business in 1982. 3 years later, his successor, Joe Williams, extracted Warner Lambert from the hospital supply business and took a $550 million write-off. He tried to focus the company on beating Merck, but his successor then threw the company back into diversification in consumer goods. And so it went, back and forth, lurch and thrash, to and fro, with each CEO trying to make a mark with his own program. From 1979 through 1998, Warner Lambert underwent three major restructurings, one per CEO, hacking away 20,000 people in search of quick breakthrough results. Time and again, the company would attain a burst of results, then slacken, never attaining the sustained momentum of a build-up, breakthrough flywheel. Stock returns flattened. and Warner Lambert disappeared as an independent company swallowed up by Pfizer. The Warner Lambert case is extreme, but we found some version of the doom loop in every comparison company. While the specific permutations of the doom loop varied from company to company, there were some highly prevalent patterns, two of which deserve particular note. The misguided use of acquisitions and the selection of leaders who undid the work of previous generations. Peter Drucker once observed that the drive for mergers and acquisitions comes less from sound reasoning and more from the fact that doing deals is a more exciting way to spend your day than doing actual work. Indeed, the comparison companies would have well understood the popular bumper sticker from the 1980s. When the going gets tough, we go shopping. To understand the role of acquisitions in the process of going from good to great, we undertook a systematic qualitative and quantitative analysis of all acquisitions and divestitures in all the companies in our study from 10 years before the transition date through 1998. While we noticed no particular pattern in the amount or scale of acquisitions, we did note a significant difference in the success rate of acquisitions in the good to great companies versus the comparisons. Why did the good to great companies have a substantially higher success rate with acquisitions, especially major acquisitions? The key to their success was that their big acquisitions generally took place after development of the hedgehog concept and after the flywheel had built significant momentum. They used acquisitions as an accelerator of flywheel momentum, not a creator of it. In contrast, the comparison companies frequently tried to jump right to breakthrough with an acquisition or merger. It never worked. Often, with their core business under siege, the comparison companies would dive into a big acquisition as a way to increase growth, diversify away their troubles, or make a CEO look good. Yet they never addressed the fundamental question. What can we do better than any other company in the world that fits our economic denominator and that we have great passion for? They never learned the simple truth that while you can buy your way to growth, you absolutely cannot buy your way to greatness. Two big mediocrities joined together never make one great company. The second frequently observed doom loop pattern is that of new leaders who stepped in, stopped an already spinning flywheel, and threw it in a new direction. Consider Harris Corporation, which applied many of the good to great concepts in the early 1960s, and in fact began a classic build-up process that led to breakthrough results. George Dively and his successor Richard Tullis identified a hedgehog concept, based on the understanding that Harris could be the best in the world at applying technology to printing and communications. Although it did not adhere to this concept with perfect discipline, Tullis had a penchant for straying a bit outside the three circles, the company nonetheless did make enough progress to produce significant results. It looked like a promising candidate for a good to great transformation, hitting breakthrough in 1975. Then, the flywheel came to a grinding halt. In 1978, Joseph Boyd became chief executive. Boyd had previously been with Radiation Inc., a corporation acquired by Harris years earlier. His first key decision as CEO was to move the company headquarters from Cleveland to Melbourne, Florida, Radiation's hometown, and the location of Boyd's house and 47-foot powerboat, the Lazy Rascal. In 1983, Boyd threw a giant wrench into the flywheel by divesting the printing business. At the time, Harris was the number one producer of printing equipment in the world. The printing business was one of the most profitable parts of the company, generating nearly a third of total operating profits. What did Boyd do with the proceeds from selling this corporate gem? He threw the company headlong into the office automation business. But could Harris become the best in the world at office automation? Not likely. Horrendous software development programs delayed introduction of Harris's first workstation as the company stumbled onto the battlefield to confront IBM, DEC, and Wang. Then, in an attempt to jump right to a new breakthrough, Harris spent a third of its entire corporate net worth to buy Lanier Business Products, a company in the low-end word processing business. Computer World magazine wrote, Boyd targeted the automated office as a key. Unfortunately for Harris, the company had everything but an office product. The attempt to design and market a word processing system met with dismal failure, out of tune with the market, and had to be scrapped before introduction. The flywheel, which had been spinning with great momentum after Dively and Tullis, came detached from the axle, wobbled in the air, and then crashed to a grinding halt. From the end of 1973 to the end of 1978, Harris beat the market by more than five times. But from the end of 1978 to the end of 1983, Harris fell 39% behind the market, and by 1988, it had fallen over 70% behind. The doom loop replaced the flywheel. In the hardcover edition of Good to Great, on page 175, we show a diagram of the flywheel, and on page 179, we show a diagram of the doom loop. And I'm going to describe these briefly for you here. The flywheel. Picture it as a clockwise cycle going around, the flywheel building momentum. At the top, you take steps forward consistent with your hedgehog concept. That then accumulates visible results. People then are lined up and energized by those results. The flywheel builds momentum. You take more steps forward consistent with the hedgehog concept. You get more visible results. People are lined up and energized by those increased results. The flywheel builds even more momentum. Then more steps, more results, more energy, more momentum, more steps, more results, more energy, more momentum. The doom loop, on the other hand, works the opposite direction. Now picture the circle going the other way. You start with disappointing results. And you react without understanding, some sort of lurching leap into the space or a big acquisition, whatever. You have a new direction, program, leader, event, fad, acquisition, and you get no buildup, no accumulated momentum. And that leads to even more disappointing results, and more reaction without understanding, and more new programs and directions and leaders and events and fads and acquisitions, and you get less buildup, less momentum, more disappointing results, and downward into the doom loop you fall. The flywheel as a wraparound idea of good to great. When I look over the good to great transformations, the one word that keeps coming to mind is consistency. Another word offered to me by physics professor R.J. Peterson is coherence. What is 1 + 1, he asked, then paused for effect. 4. In physics, we have been talking about the idea of coherence, the magnifying effect of one factor upon another. In reading about the flywheel, I couldn't help but think of the principle of coherence. However you phrase it, the basic idea is the same. Each piece of the system reinforces the other parts of the system to form an integrated whole that is much more powerful than the sum of the parts. It is only through consistency over time, through multiple generations, that you get maximum results. In a sense, everything in this book is an extrapolation and description of the pieces of the build-up to breakthrough flywheel pattern. And standing back to survey the overall framework, we see that every factor works together to create this pattern, and each component produces a push on the flywheel. On pages 183-84 of Good to Great's hardback edition, we include a table which summarizes many of the key ideas, but the header of the table is how to tell if you're on the flywheel or if you're in the doom loop. Think of it as two columns. On the left column is signs that you're on the flywheel, and on the right column, signs that you're in the doom loop. And I'm going to now go through the table, doing one side in contrast to the other side. Sign that you're on the flywheel. You follow a pattern of buildup leading to breakthrough. Signs that you're in the doom loop. You skip buildup and try to jump right to breakthrough. Flywheel. You reach breakthrough by an accumulation of steps, one after another, turn by turn of the flywheel. It feels like an organic evolutionary process. Doom loop. Implement big programs, radical change efforts, dramatic revolutions, chronic restructuring, always looking for a miracle moment or a new savior. Flywheel. Confront the brutal facts to see clearly what steps must be taken to build momentum. Doom loop. Embrace fads and engage in management hoopla rather than confront the brutal facts. Signs you're on the flywheel. Attain consistency with a clear hedgehog concept, resolutely staying within the three circles. Sign you're on the doom loop. Demonstrate chronic inconsistency, lurching back and forth and straying far outside the three circles. Flywheel. Follow the pattern of disciplined people, first two, disciplined thought, disciplined action. Doom loop. You jump right to action without disciplined thought and without first getting the right people on the bus. On the flywheel, harness appropriate technologies to your hedgehog concept to accelerate momentum. On the doom loop, run about like Chicken Little in reaction to technology, fearful of being left behind. On the flywheel, make major acquisitions only after breakthrough, if at all, to accelerate momentum. In the doom loop, make major acquisitions before breakthrough in a doomed attempt to create momentum. On the flywheel, spend very little energy trying to motivate or align people. The momentum of the flywheel itself is infectious. Whereas on the doom loop, you spend a lot of time trying to align and motivate people, rallying them around new visions. When you're on the flywheel, you let the results do most of the talking. When you're in the doom loop, you sell the future to compensate for lack of results. And finally, when you're on the flywheel, you maintain consistency over time, each generation building on the work of previous generations, and the flywheel continues to build momentum. When you're in the doom loop, you demonstrate inconsistency over time with each new leader bringing a radical new path. The flywheel grinds to a halt, and the doom loop begins anew. It all starts with level 5 leaders who naturally gravitate toward the flywheel model. They're less interested in flashy programs that make it look like they're leading with a capital L. They're more interested in the quiet, deliberate process of pushing on the flywheel to produce results with a capital R. Getting the right people on the bus, the wrong people off the bus, and the right people in the right seats, these are all crucial steps in the early stages of buildup, very important to pushes on the flywheel. Equally important is to remember the Stockdale paradox. We're not going to hit breakthrough by Christmas, but if we keep pushing in the right direction, we will eventually hit breakthrough. This process of confronting the brutal facts helps you see the obvious, albeit difficult, steps that must be taken to turn the flywheel. Faith in the end game helps you live through the months or years of buildup. Next, when you attain deep understanding about the three circles of your hedgehog concept and begin to push in a consistent direction with that understanding, you hit breakthrough momentum and accelerate with key accelerators. Chief among them, pioneering the application of technology tied directly back to your three circles. Ultimately, to reach breakthrough means having the discipline to make a series of good decisions consistent with your hedgehog concept. Disciplined action, following from disciplined people who exercise disciplined thought. Disciplined people, disciplined thought, disciplined action. That's it. That's the essence of the breakthrough process. In short, if you diligently and successfully apply each concept in the framework, and you continue to push in a consistent direction on the flywheel, accumulating momentum step by step, turn by turn, you will eventually reach breakthrough. It might not happen today, or tomorrow, or next week. It might not even happen next year, but it will happen. And when it does, you will face an entirely new set of challenges. how to accelerate momentum in response to ever-rising expectations, and how to ensure that the flywheel continues to turn long into the future. In short, your challenge will no longer be how to go from good to great, but how to go from great to enduring great, from good to great to built to last. And that is the subject of the last chapter. Chapter summary: The Flywheel and the Doom Loop. Good to great transformations often look like dramatic revolutionary events to those observing from the outside, but they feel like organic cumulative processes to people on the inside. The confusion of end outcomes, dramatic results, with process, organic and cumulative, skews our perception of what really works over the long haul. No matter how dramatic the end result, the good to great transformations never happened in one fell swoop. There was no single defining action, no grand program, no one killer innovation, no solitary lucky break, no miracle moment. Sustainable transformations follow a predictable pattern of buildup and breakthrough. Like pushing on a giant, heavy flywheel, it takes a lot of effort to get the thing moving at all. But with persistent pushing in a consistent direction over a long period of time, the flywheel builds momentum, eventually hitting a point of breakthrough. The comparison companies followed a different pattern, the doom loop. Rather than accumulating momentum turn by turn of the flywheel, they tried to skip buildup and jump immediately to breakthrough. Then, with disappointing results, they'd lurch back and forth, to and fro, failing to maintain a consistent direction. The comparison companies frequently tried to create a breakthrough with large, misguided acquisitions. The good to great companies, in contrast, principally used large acquisitions only after breakthrough to accelerate momentum in an already fast-spinning flywheel. Some unexpected results. Those inside the good to great companies were often unaware of the magnitude of their transformation at the time. Only later, in retrospect, did it become clear. They had no name, no tagline, no launch event, no program to signify what they were doing at the time. The good to great leaders spent essentially no energy trying to create alignment, motivate the troops, or manage change. Under the right conditions, the problems of commitment, alignment, motivation, and change largely take care of themselves. Alignment principally follows from results and momentum, not the other way around. And finally, in today's investor world, we learned that short-term pressures of Wall Street were not inconsistent with following this model. The flywheel effect is not in conflict with these pressures. Indeed, it is the key to managing them. Chapter 9: From Good to Great to Built to Last. It is your work in life that is the ultimate seduction. Pablo Picasso. When we began the Good to Great research project, we had a dilemma. How should we think about the ideas in Built to Last while doing the Good to Great research? Built to Last, based on a 6-year research project conducted at Stanford Business School in the early 1990s, answered the question, what does it take to start and build an enduring great company from the ground up? My research mentor and co-author, Jerry I. Porras, and I studied 18 enduring great companies, institutions that stood the test of time, tracing their founding in some cases back to the 1800s, while becoming the iconic great companies of the late 20th century. We examined companies like Procter & Gamble, which was founded in 1837, American Express, founded in 1850, Johnson & Johnson, founded in 1886, and GE, founded in 1892. One of the companies, Citicorp, now Citigroup, was founded in 1812, the same year Napoleon marched into Moscow. The youngest companies in the study were Walmart and Sony, which traced their origins back to 1945. Just like this book, we used direct comparison companies, 3M versus Norton, Walt Disney versus Columbia Pictures, Marriott versus Howard Johnson, and so forth, for 18 matched pair comparisons. We sought to identify the essential distinctions between great companies and good companies as they endure over decades, perhaps even centuries. When I had the first summer research team assembled for the Good to Great project, I asked, what should be the role of Built to Last in doing this study? I don't think it should play any role, said Brian Bagley. I didn't join this team to do a derivative piece of work. Neither did I, said Allison Sinclair. I'm excited about a new project and a new question. It wouldn't be very fulfilling to just fill in the pieces of your other book. Wait a minute, I responded. We spent 6 years on that previous study. It might be helpful to build on our previous work. Well, I seem to recall that you got the idea for the Good to Great study when a McKinsey partner said that Built to Last didn't answer the question of how to change a good company into a great company, said Paul Weissman. What if the answers are different, Jim? The debate continued for a number of weeks. Then Stephanie Judd weighed in with the argument that swayed me. I love the ideas in Built to Last, and that's what worries me. I'm afraid that if we start with Built to Last as the frame of reference, we'll just go round in circles and we'll just prove our own biases. It became clear that there would be substantially less risk in starting from scratch, setting out to discover what we would, whether it matched Built to Last or not. Early in the research then, we made a very important decision. We decided to conduct the research for Good to Great as if Built to Last didn't even exist, had never been written, had never been done. This was the only way to clearly see the key factors in transforming a good company into a great one with minimal bias from our previous work. Then later, we could return to ask, how, if at all, do the two studies relate? 5 years later, with Good to Great complete, we were able to stand back, look at the two works in the context of each other. And looking across the two studies, I offer the following four conclusions. 1. When I consider the enduring great companies from Built to Last, I now see substantial evidence that their early leaders did in fact follow the Good to Great framework. The only real difference is that they did so as entrepreneurs in small, early-stage enterprises trying to get off the ground, rather than as CEOs trying to transform established companies from good to great. 2. In an ironic twist, I now see Good to Great not as a sequel to Built to Last, but actually as a prequel. You apply the findings in this book, in Good to Great, to create sustained great results as a startup or an established organization, and then apply the findings in Built to Last to go from great results into an enduring great company. 3. To make the shift from a company with sustained great results into an enduring great company of iconic stature, you apply the central concept from Built to Last. Discover your core values and your core purpose beyond just making money, what we call the core ideology, and combine this with the dynamic of preserve the core, stimulate progress, which comes from the Built to Last work. 4. A tremendous resonance exists between the two studies. The ideas from each enrich and inform the ideas in the other. In particular, Good to Great answers a fundamental question, raised but left unanswered and Built to Last. What is the difference between a good BHAG, big, hairy, audacious goal, and a bad BHAG? Good to Great in the early stages of Built to Last companies. Looking back on the Built to Last study, it appears that the enduring great companies did in fact go through a process of build up to breakthrough following the Good to Great framework during their formative years. Consider the build up breakthrough flywheel pattern in the evolution of Walmart. Most people think that Sam Walton just exploded onto the scene with his visionary idea for rural discount retailing hitting breakthrough almost as a startup company. But nothing could be further from the truth. Walton began in 1945 with a single dime store. He didn't open his second store until 7 years later. Walton built incrementally, step by step, turn by turn of the flywheel, until the hedgehog concept of large discount marts popped out as a natural evolutionary step in the mid-1960s. It took Walton a quarter of a century, 25 years, to grow from that single dime store to a chain of 38 Walmarts. Then, from 1970 to 2000, Walmart hit breakthrough momentum and exploded to over 3,000 stores with over $150 billion, yes, billion, in revenues. Just like the story of the chicken jumping out of the egg that we discussed in the Flywheel chapter, Walmart had been incubating for decades before the egg cracked open. As Walton himself wrote, "Somehow over the years, people have gotten the impression that Walmart was just this great idea that turned into an overnight success. But it was an outgrowth of everything we'd been doing since 1945. And like most overnight successes, it was about 20 years in the making." If there ever was a classic case of buildup leading to a hedgehog concept, followed by breakthrough momentum in the flywheel, Walmart is it. The only real difference is that Sam Walton followed the model as an entrepreneur, building a great company from the ground up, rather than as a CEO transforming an established company from good to great. But it's the same basic idea. Hewlett-Packard provides another excellent example. Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard's entire founding concept for HP was not what, but who, starting with each other. They'd been best friends in graduate school and simply wanted to build a great company together that would attract other people with similar values and standards. The founding minutes of their first meeting on August 23, 1937, begin by stating that they would design, manufacture, and sell products in the electrical engineering fields, very broadly defined. But then those same founding minutes go on to say, the question of what to manufacture was postponed. Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard stumbled around for months trying to come up with something, anything, that would get the company out of the garage. They considered yacht transmitters, air conditioning control devices, medical devices, phonograph amplifiers, you name it. They built an electronic bowling alley sensor, a clock drive for a telescope, an electronic shock jiggle machine to help overweight people lose weight. It really didn't matter what the company made in the very early days, so long as it made a technical contribution and would enable Hewlett and Packard to build a company together with other like-minded people. It was the ultimate first who, we're best friends. Then what? We don't know what we're going to make. Startup. Later, as Hewlett and Packard scaled up, as they got the flywheel turning, they stayed true to the guiding principle of first who. After World War II, even as revenue shrank with the end of their wartime contracts, they hired a whole batch of fabulous people streaming out of government labs with nothing specific in mind for them to do. Recall Packard's Law, which we cited in Chapter 3. No company can grow revenues consistently faster than its ability to get enough of the right people to implement that growth and still become a great company. Hewlett and Packard lived and breathed this concept and obtained a surplus of great people whenever the opportunity presented itself. Hewlett and Packard were themselves consummate level 5 leaders, first as entrepreneurs and later as company builders. Years after HP had established itself as one of the most important technology companies in the world, Hewlett maintained a remarkable personal humility. In 1972, HP Vice President Barney Oliver wrote a recommendation letter to the IEEE Awards Board for what they call the Founders Award. He wrote, "While our success has been gratifying, it has not spoiled our founders. Only recently, at an executive council meeting, Hewlett remarked, 'Look, we've grown because the industry grew. We were lucky enough to be sitting on the nose of a rocket when it took off. We don't deserve a damn bit of credit.'" After a moment's silence, while everyone digested this humbling comment, Packard said, "Well, Bill, at least we didn't louse it up completely." Shortly before his death, I had the opportunity to meet David Packard. Despite being one of Silicon Valley's first self-made billionaires, he lived in the same small house that he and his wife built for themselves in 1957, overlooking a simple orchard. The tiny kitchen with its dated linoleum and the simply furnished living room bespoke a man who needed no material symbols to proclaim, "I'm a billionaire. I'm important. I'm successful." His idea of a good time, said Bill Terry, who worked with Packard for 36 years, was to get some of his best friends together and string some barbed wire. Packard bequeathed his $5.6 billion estate to a charitable foundation, and upon his death, his family created a eulogy pamphlet with a photo of him sitting on a tractor in farming clothes. The caption made no reference to his stature as one of the great industrialists of the 20th century. It simply read, "David Packard, 1912 to 1996, rancher, etc." Level 5, indeed. Core ideology, the extra dimension of enduring greatness. During our interview with Bill Hewlett, we asked him what he was most proud of in his long career. "As I look back on my life's work," he said, "I'm probably most proud of having helped to create a company that, by virtue of its values, practices, and success, has had a tremendous impact on the way companies are managed around the world." The HP Way, as it became known, reflected a deeply held set of core values that distinguished the company more than any of its products. These values included technical contribution, deep, abiding respect for the individual, responsibility to the communities in which the company operates, and a deeply held belief that profit is not the fundamental goal of a company. These principles, while somewhat standard today, were radical and progressive in the 1950s. David Packard said of businessmen from those days, "While they were reasonably polite in their disagreement, it was quite evident that they firmly believed that I was not one of them, and obviously not qualified to manage an important enterprise." Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard exemplify a key extra dimension that helped elevate their company from one with just great results to an elite status, to a company of an iconic stature. That extra dimension is a guiding philosophy or a core ideology which consists of core values and a core purpose, a reason for being beyond just making money. These resemble the principles in the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, never perfectly followed, but always present, as an inspiring standard and an answer to the question of why it is important that we exist. Enduring great companies don't exist merely to deliver returns to shareholders. In a truly great company, profits and cash flow become like blood and water to a healthy body. They're not the point of life. They're just essential for life. We wrote in Built to Last about Merck's decision in the 1980s to develop and distribute a drug that cured river blindness. This painful disease afflicted over 1 million people with parasitic worms that swarmed through the eyes to cause blindness. Because those who had the disease, tribal people in remote places like the Amazon, had no money, Merck initiated the creation of an independent distribution system to get the drug to remote villages and gave the drug away free to millions of people around the world. To be clear, Merck is not a charity organization, nor does it view itself as such. Indeed, it has consistently outperformed the market as a highly profitable company, growing to nearly $6 billion in profits and beating the market by over 10 times from 1946 to 2000. Yet, despite its remarkable financial performance, Merck does not view its ultimate reason for being as making money. In 1950, George Merck, the second son of the founder, set forth his company's philosophy. "We try to remember that medicine is for the patient. It is not for the profits. The profits follow. And if we have remembered that, they have never failed to appear. The better we have remembered it, the larger they have been." An important caveat to the concept of core values is that there are no specific right core values for becoming an enduring great company. No matter what core value you propose, we found an enduring great company that does not have that specific core value. A company need not have passion for its customers, Sony didn't, or respect for the individual, Disney didn't, or quality, Walmart didn't, or social responsibility, Ford didn't, in order to become enduring and great. This was one of the most paradoxical findings from Built to Last. Core values are indeed essential for enduring greatness. And yet, it doesn't seem to matter what those core values are. The point is not what core values you have, but that you have core values, that you know what they are, that you build them explicitly into the organization, and that you preserve them over time. This notion of preserving your core ideology is a central feature of enduring great companies. The obvious question is, how do you preserve the core and yet adapt to a changing world? The answer? Embrace the key concept from Built to Last. Preserve the core and stimulate progress. Enduring great companies preserve their core values and purpose while their business strategies and operating practices endlessly adapt to a changing world. This is the magical combination of preserve the core and stimulate progress. The story of Walt Disney exemplifies this duality. In 1923, an energetic 21-year-old animator moved from Kansas City to Los Angeles, and he tried to get a job in the movie business. No film company would hire him, so he used his meager savings to rent a camera, set up a studio in his uncle's garage, and begin making animated cartoons. In 1934, Mr. Disney took the bold step, never before taken, to create a successful, full-length, animated feature film. He did Snow White, then Pinocchio, Fantasia, and Bambi. In the 1950s, Disney moved into television with the Mickey Mouse Club. Also in the 1950s, Walt Disney paid a fateful visit to a number of amusement parks and came away disgusted, calling them dirty, phony places run by tough-looking people. He decided that Disney could build something much better, perhaps even the best in the world. And the company launched a whole new business in theme parks, first with Disneyland and later with Walt Disney World and Epcot Center. Over time, Disney theme parks have become a cornerstone experience for many families from all over the world. Throughout all these dramatic changes, from cartoons to full-length feature animation, from Mickey Mouse Club to Disney World, the company held firmly to a consistent set of core values that included a passionate belief in creative imagination, fanatic attention to detail, abhorrence of cynicism, and preservation of what they call the Disney magic. Mr. Disney also instilled a remarkable constancy of purpose that permeated every new Disney venture, namely, to bring happiness to millions, especially children. This purpose cut across national borders and has endured through time. When my wife and I visited Israel in 1995, we met the man who brought Disney products to the Middle East. The whole idea, he told us with pride, is to bring a smile to a child's face. That's really important here, where there aren't enough smiles on the children. Walt Disney provides a classic case of preserve the core and stimulate progress, holding a core ideology fixed while changing strategies and practices over time. And its adherence to this principle is the fundamental reason why it has endured as a great company. On page 196-197 of the hardcover edition, you will see a diagram, if you look in the book, that is a yin and yang diagram. This is the way that we came to describe the whole preserve, core, stimulate, progress idea. The left side of the yin-yang is about preserve. The right side of the yin-yang is about change. On the left side of the yin-yang, you have preserve, core values, and core purpose. On the right hand of the yin-yang, you have change. Change cultural practices, change operating practices, change goals, change strategies, change culture, change everything that's not part of those values and that core purpose. And it is this yin and yang dynamic between the two, the tension between the two, that provides that magic elixir of continuity and change. BHAGs, bad BHAGs, and other conceptual links. In a table on page 198 of the hardcover edition of Good to Great, I've outlined a sketch of conceptual links between the two studies. As a general pattern, the Good to Great ideas appear to lay the groundwork for the ultimate success of the Built to Last ideas. I like to think of Good to Great as providing the core ideas for getting the flywheel turning from build-up to breakthrough, while Built to Last outlines the core ideas for keeping a flywheel accelerating long into the future and elevating a company to iconic stature. Each of the Good to Great findings enables all four of the key ideas from Built to Last. To briefly review here, those four key ideas are: Idea number one, clock building, not time telling. Build an organization that can endure and adapt through multiple generations of leaders and multiple product life cycles, the exact opposite of being built around a single great leader or a single great idea. Idea number two, genius of the and. Embrace both extremes on a number of dimensions at the same time. Instead of choosing A or B, figure out how to have A and B, purpose and profit, continuity and change, freedom and responsibility. The genius of and prevailing over the tyranny of or. Concept number three, core ideology. Instill core values, essential and enduring tenets, if you will, and core purpose, a fundamental reason for being beyond just making money, as principles to guide decisions and inspire people throughout the organization over a long period of time. And number four, the central organizing idea of Built to Last, preserve the core and stimulate progress. Preserve the core ideology, preserve the core values, preserve the core purpose as an anchor point, while stimulating change, improvement, innovation, renewal, and everything else. Change practices, change strategies, while holding core values and purpose fixed. Set and achieve BHAGs, big, hairy, audacious goals, consistent with the core ideology. I'd like to highlight one particularly powerful link between Good to Great and Built to Last: the connection between BHAGs and the three circles of the hedgehog concept. In Built to Last, we identified BHAGs as a key way to stimulate progress while preserving the core. A BHAG, short for Big, Hairy, Audacious Goal, is a huge and daunting objective, like a big mountain to climb. It is clear, compelling, and people get it right away. A BHAG serves as a unifying focal point of effort, galvanizing people and creating team spirit as people strive toward a finish line. Like the 1960s NASA moon mission, a BHAG captures the imagination and grabs people in the gut. The problem is, as exciting as BHAGs are, we left a vital question unanswered. What's the difference between a bad BHAG and a good BHAG? Swimming from Australia to New Zealand would be a BHAG for me, but it would also kill me. That would make it qualify as a bad BHAG. Well, we can now offer an answer to that question, drawing directly from the study of the Good to Great companies. Bad BHAGs, it turns out, are set with bravado. Good BHAGs are set with understanding. Indeed, when you combine the quiet understanding of the three circles with the audacity of a BHAG, you get a powerful, almost magical mix. In other words, go back to the three circles. Top circle, passion. Bottom left circle, best at. Bottom right circle, economic or resource engine. You find the intersection of those three circles, and your BHAG should fall right in the middle of those three circles. A superb example comes from Boeing in the 1950s. Until the early 1950s, Boeing focused on building huge flying machines for the military. The B-17 Flying Fortress, the B-29 Super Fortress, and later the B-52 Intercontinental Jet Bomber Stratofortress. However, Boeing had virtually no presence in the commercial aircraft market, and the airline showed no interest in buying aircraft from Boeing. "You make great bombers up there in Seattle. Why don't you just stick with that?" they said in response to Boeing's inquiries. Today, we take for granted that most air travel takes place on Boeing jets, but in 1952, almost no one outside the military flew on Boeing. Through the 1940s, Boeing had stayed away from the commercial sphere. It was an arena in which McDonnell Douglas had vastly superior abilities in the smaller, propeller-driven planes that composed the commercial fleet. In the 1950s, however, Boeing saw an opportunity to leapfrog McDonnell Douglas by marrying its experience with large aircraft to its understanding of jet engines. Led by a Level 5 leader named Bill Allen, Boeing executives debated the wisdom of moving into the commercial sphere. They came to understand that whereas Boeing could not have been the best commercial plane maker a decade earlier, the cumulative experience in jets and big planes they'd gained from military contracts now made such a dream possible. They also came to see that the economics of commercial aircraft would be vastly superior to the military market. And, of no small importance, they were just flat out turned on by the whole idea of building a commercial jet. It ignited their passions. So in 1952, Bill Allen and his team made the decision to spend a quarter of the company's entire net worth to build a prototype jet that could be used for commercial aviation. They built the 707 and launched Boeing on a bid to become the leading commercial aviation company in the world. 3 decades later, after producing 5 of the most successful commercial jets in history, the 707, the 727, 37, 47, and 57, Boeing stood as the absolute unquestioned greatest company in the commercial airplane industry. Not until the late 1990s would Boeing's number one position be seriously challenged, and it would take a government consortium in the form of Airbus to do it. Here's the key point of the story. Boeing's BHAG, while huge, daunting, audacious, was not any random goal. It was a goal that made sense within the context of the three circles. Boeing executives understood with calm equanimity, one, that the company could become the best in the world at commercial jet manufacturing, even though it had no presence in the market. Two, the shift would significantly improve Boeing's economics by increasing profit per aircraft model. And three, the Boeing people were very passionate about the idea. Boeing acted with understanding, not bravado, at this pivotal moment in its history. The Boeing case underscores a key point. To retain greatness over time requires, on the one hand, staying squarely within the three circles, while on the other hand, being willing to change the specific manifestation of what's inside the three circles at any given moment. Boeing in 1952 never left the three circles or abandoned its core ideology, but it created an exciting new BHAG and adjusted its hedgehog concept to include commercial aircraft. The three-circle BHAG framework provides one powerful example of how the ideas from the two studies, Good to Great and Built to Last, link together. And I offer it here as a practical tool for creating this link within your own specific case. Yet it alone will not make your company great and lasting. To create an enduring great company requires all the key concepts from both studies tied together and applied consistently over time. And remember, if you ever stop doing any one of the key ideas, you will slide backward toward mediocrity. Remember, it's much easier to become great than to remain great. Ultimately, the consistent application of both studies, one building upon the other, gives the best chance for creating greatness that lasts. Why greatness? During a break at a seminar that I gave to a group of my ex-students from Stanford, one came up to me, brow furrowed. "Maybe I'm just not ambitious enough," he said, "but I really don't want to build a huge company. Is there something wrong with that?" Not at all, I replied. Greatness doesn't depend on size. I then told him about Sina Cementov, who runs the building where I have my research laboratory. Sina created a truly great institution. It's an old 1892 red brick school building that's been renovated into the most extraordinary space, decorated and maintained with tremendous attention to detail, bordering on perfection. By one definition of results, attracting the most interesting people in Boulder, setting a standard that other local buildings measure themselves against, and generating the highest profit per foot of space, his small enterprise is truly a great institution in my hometown. Sina Cementov has never defined greatness by size, and there is no reason for him to. The student paused for a moment, then said, okay, I accept that I don't need to build a big company in order to have a great company. But even so, why should I try to build a great company? What if I just want to be successful? The question brought me up short. This was not a lazy person asking. He'd started his own business as a young man, put himself through law school, and after graduate school became a driven entrepreneur. He has a remarkable energy, an intense and infectious enthusiasm. Of all the students I've known over the years, he is one that I have little doubt will be enormously successful. Yet he questions. He questions the whole idea of trying to build something great and lasting. I can offer two answers. First, I believe that it is no harder to build something great than to build something good. It might be statistically more rare to reach greatness, but it does not require more suffering than perpetuating mediocrity. Indeed, if some of the comparison companies in our study are any indication, building greatness involves less suffering and perhaps even less work. The beauty and power of the research findings is that they can radically simplify our lives while increasing our effectiveness. There's great solace in the simple fact of clarity about what is vital and what is not. The point of this entire book is not that we should add these findings to what we are already doing and make ourselves even more overworked. No. The point is to realize that much of what we're doing is at best a waste of energy. If we organize the vast majority of our work time around these principles and pretty much ignored or stopped everything else, our lives would be simpler and our results improved. Let me illustrate this with a non-business example, the last story of this book. The coaching staff of a high school cross-country running team recently got together for dinner after winning its second state championship in 2 years. The program had been transformed in the previous 5 years from good, top 20 in state, to great, consistent contenders for the state championship on both the boys' and girls' teams. I don't get it, said one of the coaches. Why are we so successful? We don't work any harder than other teams. And what we do is just so simple. Why does it work? He was referring to the hedgehog concept of the program, captured in this simple statement. We run best at the end. We run best at the end of workouts. We run best at the end of races. And we run best at the end of the season when it counts the most. Everything is geared to this simple idea, and the coaching staff knows how to create this effect better than any other team in the state. For example, they place a coach at the 2-mile mark of a 3.1-mile race to collect data as the runners go past. But unlike most teams, which collect time splits, minutes per mile running pace, this team collects place splits, what place the runners are in as they go by. Then the coaches calculate not how fast the runners go, but how many competitors they pass at the end of the race, from mile 2 to the finish. They then use this data to award head bones after each race. Head bones are beads in the shape of shrunken skulls, which the